Good afternoon. We're going to start now. I'm John Samples. I'm director of the Center for Representative Government at the Cato Institute. And today I'll be moderating our forum on voting fraud and the question of voting fraud, sponsored by the Federalist Society. Within a little bit over a month, we will be going to the polls once again to elect the president. And as usual, there are a number of substantive questions, which we'll hear discussed tonight, I'm sure, at some length. There's also a number of questions about process. The typical one that we always have in presidential elections is there too much money being spent? Is it being spent badly or for bad purposes? This time around, though, we have one that's a relatively new question, I think. It's an age-old question in some respects, but to be discussed at the highest levels and as part of a presidential election, I think, is somewhat new. And it's the question of the integrity of the ballot. So today we're going to be discussing the issue of voting fraud. Some people, including our guest today, or one of our speakers, argue that, in fact, there's lots of issues and questions about the integrity of the ballot. We need to do something about it. On the other side, there's a very large number of people who say, in fact, this is just an illusion. There's no real problems. There's some problems to be dealt with, but that's not one of them. We ought to not be doing anything. A couple of things that you could say in general terms that apart perhaps from what our speakers will talk about today. One is that a number of states have acted in this area to pass voting ID laws on the basis of a concern about the integrity of the ballot. And one can say also, I think, fairly clearly that these kinds of actions, voting ID laws, are in fact pretty popular. They clearly, in the polls that I've seen, attract a majority of the vote, so a majority of people who are citizens. But there's also, as always, this is not just a majoritarian republic, a majoritarian democracy. There's also the whole question of law, which is particularly apt for the Federalist Society to have an event on this. The question of voter ID has been to the Supreme Court, and even just yesterday, as perhaps we'll see more in the next 2 to 3 weeks, a Pennsylvania court ruled that, in fact, the voting ID law in Pennsylvania had to be given some more scrutiny. And I'm sure our speakers will get to these issues of law. In fact, I would ask them, particularly for our audience today, to deal with the issue of law. And particularly, I want to learn something because my understanding of the doctrine here is, as far as voting ID goes, yes, but. And what does but mean? So our first speaker today will be John Fun. John is the co-author of a new book, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. So that book is available now in bookstores and elsewhere. John is National Affairs columnist at National Review and senior editor of the American Spectator. He was previously a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, where he wrote a weekly column named On the Trail and contributed to the journal's newsletter, Political Diary. He joined the journal in April 1984 as deputy editorial features editor. He became an editorial page writer, specializing in politics and government in October of 1986, and was a member of the editorial board from 1995 to 2001. He worked initially as a research analyst for the California State Legislature in Sacramento before beginning his journalism career in 1982 as a reporter for the syndicated columnist Rowan Evans and the late Robert Novak. In 1993, he received the Warren Brooks Award for Journalistic Excellence from the American Legislative Exchange Council. He and former Pennsylvania Representative James Cohn are co-authors of the book Cleaning House, America's Campaign for Term Limits. Mr. Fund attended California State University, where he studied journalism and economics. And since we are at a legal setting here, I will settle one of the great undecided issues. John Fun was, in fact, the first intern at the Cato Institute. John?
Back then, Cato was in San Francisco, which is where I'm from. Since then, I've lived in various other places around the country. I've never lived in a zip code where very many people agreed with me. The subject is a very timely one for obvious reasons. Almost everyone in this room remembers the Florida 2000 election. It was, I think, a stain and a scar on our nation's psyche. 47 days of constitutional crisis, charges of bureaucratic bungling, charges of intimidation, charges of fraud. It was a mess. The president took office, George W. Bush, in January 2001, with over 40% of the people deciding he was illegitimate. And we now are in a very strained domestic and foreign policy crisis. I don't want that to happen again. And I think there are steps we can take between now and Election Day to minimize the risk of another Florida-style meltdown, because the underbrush, the bureaucratic confusion, and the charges and countercharges that we see in this election are so much greater than they were in 2000. There are 10,000 lawyers that are going to be monitoring this election on both sides. 10,000 lawyers equals litigation. You no longer have to win with a margin of victory. You need to win with a margin beyond litigation. In 2004, the Kerry Edwards campaign said privately that if Ohio had been within 50,000 votes, they would have gone to court. It ended up being a little over 100,000, so they didn't. But we could very easily see a very close election, and I don't want us to go through another Florida. Now, there are many things that can be done to clean up our election systems. One of them is the parlous state of our voter registration rolls. The Pew Research Center, this is not me, this is the Pew Research Center, reports that 2.8 million Americans are registered to vote in more than one state. We are recently seeing reports from various watchdog groups that a large number of people not only register in more than one state, but they often vote in more than one state. Just last month, a congressional nominee from a district not far from here in Maryland had to resign her position because she had voted in both Florida and Virginia multiple times. She apparently was very civically minded. The New York Daily News found a few years ago that 46,000 people were registered to vote in both New York City and Florida, and between 600 and 1,000 of them had voted repeatedly in elections in both states. That doesn't sound like a lot, but Florida was decided, and the presidency of the United States was decided in 2000 by 537 votes. Pew Research Center also found that 1.8 million dead people are on our voter registration rolls. I believe we should honor the dead. I do not believe that they deserve representation without respiration, however. They also found, the Pew Research Center, that 1 out of 8 voter registrations of this country are either invalid or contain major errors. Now, this bureaucratic bungling, this slipshod system, can have consequences because it can create a template, in some cases even an invitation, to voter fraud. And why is this important? Well, there are civil rights involved here. We fought a great civil rights struggle in the 1960s, and it has continued since then to make sure that no one is intimidated from voting, no one is prevented from voting, there are no artificial barriers to voting. We passed a Voting Rights Act. We need to preserve those gains. In some areas, I think we need to do even more. That's a civil right. But you know, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in upholding an Arizona ID law that you can also be disenfranchised another way. If your vote is canceled out by someone who shouldn't be voting, someone who's voting twice, someone who doesn't exist, someone who's an illegal alien, someone who's a felon not with their rights restored yet, your vote can be canceled out by an illegal voter, an improper voter. And that's a voting right we also should care about. In 2002, in the aftermath of Florida, Senator Chris Dodd, who was the Democratic co-sponsor of the Help America Vote Act, said the goal of all future legislation in this area should be twofold. It should be to make it easy to vote and at the same time make it harder to cheat. And he said, we are Americans, we can do both. I think we can do both. I think it is unfortunate that this issue has divided so clearly along partisan lines, ideological lines. And I think that's unfortunate because I think most of the division has been at the elite level. If you go to public opinion polls, the American people view this as common sense, that we can make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. On the issue of photo ID, the Washington Post survey confirms all the other surveys. It was taken just a month ago. 74% of the American people support voter ID. Obviously, not all of those are created equal, and we'll have some discussion about whether some are too restrictive or not. But 74%, that includes 65% of African Americans, 64% of Hispanics, 60% of Democrats. In fact, there were 38 demographic categories in the Washington Post survey. In 37, there was a clear majority for photo ID. The last group, progressive, self-described progressive liberals, otherwise known as MSNBC viewers, was 48% in favor, 44% against, even though it had a plurality. Why is this? Because it's common sense. We can construct photo ID laws and laws that also combat absentee ballot fraud, which I agree is a bigger problem, and clean up the voter registration rolls. We can do all three. And I support states doing all three. I do not believe in states doing an incomplete job. So I very much support states addressing all three of those considerations. Does voter fraud matter? Yes. Does it exist? Well, we're told it doesn't. We were told over and over again there is no voter fraud. There was a student group called News 21, which purported to show there were very few voter fraud prosecutions in this country. There have been studies by the RNLA and other groups that show that their study is very flawed because almost all voter fraud prosecutions are at the county level. That's where we do our election administration. Federal and state is a very small fraction of that. The News 21 study purported to address county issues, but they got enormous non-response from many counties. Their footnotes explaining why their study was limited and flawed almost often overwhelmed the text of the actual articles. In 2004, we had bureaucratic bungling and voter fraud in the Washington State Governor's race. 129 votes separated the two candidates at the end. The King County Board of Elections found new ballots 18 different times during the recount. Sometimes you can't tell where the incompetence ends and the fraud begins. A judge who did not overturn the election nonetheless ruled there were more illegal votes cast in that election than the margin of difference. He just couldn't prove who was voting for whom. In 2008, we had the Minnesota Senate race, which was very important. Senator Al Franken, who took office with a 312-vote margin, provided the 60th vote for Obamacare. It had to get 60 votes to break a filibuster. We have Obamacare. Now, Senator Franken is legitimately the senator from Minnesota, but we did learn after the election that 1,100 felons voted illegally in that election, 1,100 in a 312-vote margin. Now, in Minnesota, you basically can't prosecute people unless they're foolish enough to prove their intent to commit the crime. So if you say, I forgot, I didn't know I couldn't vote, you're not going to be prosecuted. But enough felons, and you know, felons can be dumb, after all, they did get caught. Felons, some were dumb enough to say, yeah, I knew it was wrong, I did it anyway, what's it to you, copper? And we have 198 felons who have already been convicted of voting illegally in that election. 66 more in the pipeline, dozens more under investigation. It is conceivable we could have more people convicted of voter fraud in that election, the Al Franken election, than the actual margin of victory. But of course, there is no voter fraud. Well, just looking at some headlines from the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I'll finish up with this. We are told non-citizens don't vote, they don't vote illegally. In Iowa, 3 people were sent to jail just last week. 2 Canadians and 1 Mexican, their crime, repeatedly voting in U.S. elections. 430 people wrote in to the Colorado Secretary of State and said, we hear there's some discussion non-citizens can't vote. Well, I'm a non-citizen and I'm voting, so please take, or registered, and please take my registration off the rolls. Arkansas, Bill Clinton denounced efforts to combat voter fraud and integrity, saying it was a solution in search of a problem at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. 2 hours before he mounted the podium, back in his native Arkansas, a state legislator, a state city councilman, and a police official all pled guilty to 45 counts of voter fraud in an election decided by 8 votes. But there is no voter fraud. On and on and on, we see this as a potential problem. I think we can do both. I think we can improve our voter registration system. I think we can streamline it. I think we can clean up our voter registration rolls. I think we can improve access to the polls, but I also think we can take common sense efforts that will combat and discourage voter fraud. Even if you don't prevent all of it, you can deter it. You know, people who study shoplifting will tell you, if you don't put cameras up and you don't put signs up and you don't tell people there's any risk at all, you will get more shoplifting. Well, with voter fraud, if you put a few signs up and you have a few people who get prosecuted, a few more than we do now, and you have some impediment to people just walking in and committing the crime, either through absentee ballots or at the polls, you can reduce the incidence of voter fraud. And in conclusion, as the Supreme Court has said, confidence in the integrity and honesty and completeness of an election are fundamental to our democracy. And if people lose confidence in the integrity of elections because there are insufficient steps taken to make sure that integrity is maintained, we will lose something essential to our democracy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Our second commentator today will be Elizabeth Wadra. Elizabeth is the Constitutional Accountability Center's chief counsel. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeal. She joined CAC from private practice at Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, Oliver, and Hedges in San Francisco, where she was an attorney working with former Stanford Law Dean Kathleen Sullivan. Previously, Elizabeth was a supervising attorney and teaching fellow at Georgetown University Law Center. It's the Appellate Litigation Clinic, and a law clerk for Judge James R. Browning of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Elizabeth has appeared on television as a legal expert for NBC, ABC, CNN, Fox News, and Fox Business Channel, and Current TV, spanning the range, the known range of ideological TV, and has appeared on NPR's All Things Considered and nationally syndicated radio programs. Her writings have appeared in Slate, numerous political and legal blogs, the Huffington Post, and the ACS blog. She's also published in the Syracuse Law Review and the Yale Journal of International Law. Elizabeth is a graduate of Yale Law School. Please welcome Elizabeth Wadra.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me here today. It's always a pleasure to be a participant in Federalist Society events or in the audience as well. They always do a great job. And I think it's very important for us to be discussing the issue of voting rights and voter fraud today, not just because we're about a month out from a presidential election, but also because this year marks the 225th anniversary of the signing of our Constitution. As the delegates to the Constitutional Convention who signed their names to our founding charter well understood, the right to vote is fundamental and nearly sacred in our American democracy. And because they understood this, when they sent the Constitution to the states for ratification, they sought to have the most democratic birth of a nation in history. Even in the shadow of slavery, even in a society where women were treated as second-class citizens, the founding generation took small steps to expand the vote. Many states relaxed their existing property requirements to vote, and others allowed free African Americans to vote. The ratification vote became, as my dear law professor Akhil Amar likes to say, a hinge of modern history, the most democratic event the world had ever seen. Over the next two centuries, we the people poured blood, sweat, and treasure into reform efforts that resulted in the six voting amendments that importantly expanded the right to vote and brought even more people into the American democracy. These amendments guaranteed the franchise without discrimination to African Americans, women, the young, the poor. But today, state governments around the country threaten this arc of voting progress with a spate of restrictive voter identification laws. And I think John is right that there is a variety of, measures that can be taken to address other instances of election fraud, but because voter ID is sort of the imminent issue right now, that's what I'm going to focus on today. So what's particularly troubling to me about voter ID laws is that they threaten to disenfranchise millions of Americans, including, and perhaps especially including, those whom we fought so hard to have included in the franchise in the first place, African Americans, young people, and the poor. Am I going to defend our nation's election system as flawless? No, I think John is right. There are definite places where it could improve and where we could do more to make our system as free, fair, and accessible to all Americans as possible. But the story that John tells in his book in support of voter ID laws is based on a fiction about voter fraud. A Carnegie Knight investigative reporting project, which John referred to as the student group, recently demonstrated that in-person voting fraud that voter ID laws are meant to remedy is extremely, extremely rare. This study looked at more than 2,000 cases of alleged election fraud over the past dozen years and found 10 cases of alleged in-person voter fraud. With about 146 million registered voters, this comes down to about one instance of in-person voter fraud per 15 million registered prospective voters. Contrast this one in every 15 million prospective voters statistic with the result found by the Brennan Center and backed up by state surveys in Tennessee and Pennsylvania, that one in 10 eligible voters lack the sufficient ID that these new restrictive voter ID laws request. One in 10 Americans eligible to vote could be disenfranchised based on a threat of election fraud that occurs approximately one in every 15 million eligible voters. Now, John doesn't like the Brennan Center study, as you can read in his book, but you don't have to take their word for it. Recently, a federal court considering Texas's voter ID law found that that state's law would have a retrogressive effect on groups such as African Americans, Hispanics, and the poor, because these groups lack, there's a substantial number within this population that lacks the requisite ID, and there would be a substantial burden upon those folks in order to get it. But now, as John says, and as many of you might be wondering, what are all these people doing wandering around without photo ID? What's wrong with asking voters for identification when they go to the polls? Well, nothing, per se, as the Supreme Court has noted. It's just that these restrictive voter ID laws ask for specific identification that many eligible voters don't have. Is it hard to get this ID? Maybe not for John or for me or for most of us in this room, but for Americans who live long distances from the agency where they can get this ID, for Americans who don't have a car or are elderly and infirm and can't travel to get the agency, to get to the agency where they can get this identification, for Americans who can't afford to take time off during their work week because many of these agencies are not open on the weekend to get this ID, it's a real burden. It's also a burden for those who cannot afford to get these identifications. And you may think, well, wait, these IDs generally are available free. Sure, but not the supporting documents that you need to get the free identification. Those can range in Texas, if you need a birth certificate for your photo ID, it costs about $22. To put it in perspective, the poll tax that was outlawed, fortunately, during the voting rights movements of the last century, that was about $10 in today's dollars. So this is a serious burden on one of the most important political liberties protected by the Constitution, a political liberty that is preservative of all other rights. Well, that's a shame, you may say. You know, sure, we don't want to burden constitutional rights, and I think John has made clear about that. But, you know, what about all the fraud that he talks about? We should also be focused on that. Well, I think it's important to be clear about what voter ID laws are meant to do. They are intended to combat in-person voter fraud, not absentee ballot misuse, not felon votes, not voter registration fraud, and not the systemic dysfunction that we saw in the Florida in Florida in the 2000 election. Although I think that we can both agree that that left a stain on all of our psyches, certainly did for me. But so anecdotes about this kind of election fraud used to support voter ID laws are, I would submit, are really misdirection. But you might say, since we're talking about democracy here, what about the polls that both our moderator and John mentioned that show that Americans support voter ID laws? Well, I'm sure I don't have to remind my conservative and libertarian brethren that under our Constitution, we don't parse out our fundamental rights based on opinion polls. But secondly, it's not just about ID or not no ID. It's about these specific restrictive voter ID laws. And, you know, here I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that Texas, for example, is trying to ban student IDs, out-of-state driver's licenses, and state government employee IDs. But I think what is most telling, and what I'll wrap up on, is what happens when these claims of in-person voter fraud move from the court of public opinion to the court of law. In the court of law, you need cold, hard evidence, not anecdotes or rhetoric, however stirring John's prose and rhetoric may be. And no state defending its voter ID law has offered up proof that in-person voter fraud is rampant and real. Not Texas, not South Carolina, not Pennsylvania. And in fact, on that point, I'll close with a brief quotation of some stipulations that were entered into by Pennsylvania, by all the parties, in the Pennsylvania voter ID litigation. Quote, the parties are not aware of any incidents of in-person voter fraud in Pennsylvania and do not have direct personal knowledge of in-person voter fraud elsewhere. Respondents, that is Pennsylvania, will not offer any evidence in this action that in-person voter fraud has in fact occurred in Pennsylvania or elsewhere. Respondents, again Pennsylvania, will not offer any evidence or argument that in-person voter fraud is likely to occur in November 2012 in the absence of the photo ID law. But maybe they just haven't read John's book. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Now, what I would like to do is each of our speakers take just a minute or two to respond to what's been said, and then we'll go, obviously, to questions and answers. John, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, in-person voter fraud is not the only thing that is covered by an ID. It can prevent double voting. It can prevent voting by people who are out of state. It can prevent fictitious registration voting. You're voting under someone else's name. And according to all of the felons who were interviewed in the Minnesota election, if they had been asked to show an ID, many of them would have been deterred from voting illegally in that election, especially those that knew that they were voting illegally at the time. Pennsylvania's law is the one we're all talking about. It's not nearly as draconian as it's been depicted. The judge who initially ruled that it could be implemented and then had to backtrack because of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's admonition, looked at every one of the witnesses that had come before the court and found individually they could all easily vote. The lead plaintiff's witness, a 93-year-old woman whose purse had been stolen and said she couldn't get an ID, she told a tale of great woe. The day after the judge's decision, she took the bus down to the local transportation office, got her ID in 20 minutes and held it up for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Her lawyers blew a gasket. This is called being off message. All of those people could have easily voted. In Pennsylvania, if you don't have the requisite ID, you can vote absentee. Nothing prevents you from voting absentee. Now, there are additional preventive measures in the Pennsylvania law to limit absentee voter fraud, but you can always vote absentee if you don't have an ID. Secondly, you show up at the polls, and let's say you forgot your ID, or you don't have it. You have 6 days to transmit a copy of an ID by fax, email, regular mail, or in person. Let's say you don't have the money for the supporting documentation. You can sign an affidavit saying you could not afford the documentation to get an ID. You do not cast a provisional ballot. Vote will be counted. You do not have to show an ID in Pennsylvania. That is the law. If you don't have an ID and you can't afford the documentation, you sign the affidavit, your vote will be counted. They didn't tell you that. Lastly, there's a reason why Texas won't allow student ID. Texas Texas has in-state tuition discounts for illegal aliens. They get a student ID if they're going to college. If you have a student ID and you're an illegal alien, you shouldn't be voting. So of course Texas is not going to allow student ID as part of the form of identification, because an illegal alien could possess a student ID by their state law. Lastly, you know, groups fighting these laws have been spending millions and millions of dollars. Publicity machines, legal costs, witnesses, the whole bit. Andrew Young, who supported Georgia's ID law because it had extensive outreach efforts to the community, including mobile vans that would go out and find the people who didn't have IDs, he said, "I don't see what this fuss is all about. You can't be part of the mainstream of American life if you don't have an ID. You can't get a job. You can't cash a check. You can't get a Social Security benefit. You can't go to the doctor. They should ask for ID and go to the doctor. Can't get married, gay or otherwise. You can't do anything." He said, "Let's get people an ID. We're doing them a favor. If part of this money that was being spent on these lawsuits were spent in outreach, getting people an ID, we could solve the problem and avoid the lawyers." And lastly, what Andrew Young told me, this is not controversial because every African American knows that the Brennan Center's reported statistic that 25% of African Americans don't have an ID is just preposterous. It's patronizing to say that. It's preposterous. Is there anyone in this room who believes 25% of African Americans, according to the Brennan Center, don't have an ID? This is whenever this goes to court, the courts, whether it's Indiana or Georgia, say it's less than 0.5%, and the study for the American electorate at American University agrees. They studied three states. And the American University Center for the Study of the American Electorate is the premier academic institution in this area. I'll take them over the Brennan Center's 25% figure any day.
I bet Elizabeth has a different view about that.
I do. Thank you. And in fact, I'd like to start not with my view, but with the view of a three-judge federal court panel considering Texas's law. And I think it is important to recognize that not all voter ID laws are the same. Some are less restrictive. For example, Virginia's law, which was given preclearance by the Department of Justice under the Voting Rights Act. And Texas, I think, is one of the more restrictive ones. But so the federal court, considering Texas, said that the record evidence suggests that the voter ID law in that state, if implemented, would in fact have a retrogressive effect on Hispanic and African American voters. This conclusion flows from three basic facts, not one of which you will see is the Brennan Center's 25% figure. One, a substantial subgroup of Texas voters, many of whom are African American or Hispanic, lack photo ID. Two, the burdens associated with obtaining ID will weigh most heavily on the poor. And three, racial minorities in Texas are disproportionately likely to live in poverty. Accordingly, the court came to the conclusion that voter ID law in Texas is likely to have a negative effect on racial minorities with respect to their effective exercise of the electoral franchise. So it's not just the Brennan Center, it's federal judges who have considered the record evidence, all the experts. You know, and I think, again, that's why I like to focus on there is a vast gulf between what is said in the public and what goes on in courts of law when they actually consider voter fraud. I think the Senator Franken election is a great example of that. You know, it's not like this happened over a weekend. There was 8 months with armies of lawyers looking into allegations of voter fraud. And all of the judges, both Democratic and Republican appointees, looked at the evidence and did not find any findings of voter fraud in that case. So, you know, it's not as if these guys didn't have the biggest incentive possible to find voter fraud. And in fact, Norm Coleman stipulated that they did not have evidence of in-person voter fraud. So I think that, you know, it's important to take these anecdotes for what they are and then look at what the people who have the most incentive to put forth this evidence actually come up with in court. And so far, that's been nothing.
To get us kicked off on the questions and answers, I've been asked to pose a couple of questions to our speakers as while you think about yours and what you might want to ask them. I have to begin with a confession. It's pretty embarrassing, but I've got to make it. I am not a lawyer by trade. I am a political scientist. And so from time to time, I've talked to people about this issue, other political scientists. And so what I want to pose to both of our speakers are what would be the tough question a political scientist would like to pose to them about their factual claims, because after all, we don't have, it doesn't seem yet, or maybe ever, dispositive evidence about the factual claims. For John Fun first, the political scientist would say, you know, impersonation fraud is a fairly complicated business, and to pull it off successfully would be a fairly complicated business, it would seem, because you would have to think of all the things you have to go through in terms of identifying people and so on, and registration and getting them to vote. So therefore, on that basis, yes, there's going to be some impersonation fraud, but in terms of enough of it happening to affect most state elections, it seems pretty unlikely to the political scientist. Now for Elizabeth. The claim, of course, is that there will be significant voter suppression. But the fact is that if you look at vote, there is actually not everyone votes to begin with, and really high numbers are somewhere between 50 and 55%, which suggests, and is part of the political science literature, that people that end up voting are pretty, you know, intent on it. They're pretty well motivated. So the problem seems to be with the significant suppression thesis is the people that are going to vote are pretty motivated to begin with, and an additional ID is probably pretty unlikely to cause them to not vote, or again, the significant question, significant numbers of them not to vote. So let's go back to John Fund.
Well, first of all, as I said, voter ID laws cover double voting, voting by illegal aliens, voting people from out of state, fictitious registrations, and can deter felon voting. It's not just voter impersonation. As for voter impersonation, yes, a lot of it is anecdotal because it is very difficult to detect this type of fraud. I refer to the Seventh Circuit Court opinion upholding Indiana's law, which said, quote, it is virtually impossible, unquote, to detect this kind of fraud. Let me give an example. A 22-year-old white kid with a beard and a scraggly facial hair and an earring walks into the polling place in Washington, D.C., where Eric Holder has lived for 32 years. He doesn't say he's Eric Holder. He just says, do you have an Eric Holder at such and such an address? He's handed his ballot, no questions asked. He asks to show his ID. He's told, no, you don't have to show an ID. He leaves saying he feels more comfortable if he could get his ID from the car and says he'll be back faster than anyone can be furious. Eric Holder has lived in that neighborhood for 32 years. He never voted in primaries, because primaries don't matter that much in Washington, D.C. Somebody who could figure out that he had never voted in primaries could easily have voted Eric Holder's name, and we would never have known. If you voted the name of a dead person, how likely are they to complain? Not very likely. Chris Matthews is a big opponent of voter ID laws. Big opponent. But this is what he said on Hardball. This type of impersonation fraud has gone on in Philadelphia since the 50s. Someone calls to inquire whether you have voted or are going to vote, and then all of a sudden somebody does come and vote for you. This is an old strategy in big city politics. I know all about it in North Philly, where I'm from. It's what went on, and of course it still goes on. Now, this is anecdotal, but we don't have to discuss that this is non-existent. And absentee ballot fraud, which is also in my book, is also something very important. Lastly, I would just say, close election is something we're seeing more and more of. Increasingly, elections are being decided by a very small number of votes. Florida was 537 votes. We're going to see very close races in many states. Even a few votes can make a difference. And if an election is close, the incentive to commit this kind of voter fraud goes up. In 2000, which was a very, very hotly contested race, a Park Avenue heiress flew to Milwaukee, Wisconsin on her own dime, spent thousands and thousands of dollars, and she was convicted of this, taking homeless people and busing them from polling place to polling place and paying them off in cigarettes. She spent thousands of dollars doing this. She was able to do this because in many states you can same-day registration and vote. She was convicted of it. They asked her why she did it, and she said, the election was close. I felt I had to do something. So she flew all the way from New York to do it. This is not unprecedented. It does happen. And if you can deter it, even if it doesn't happen often, as the Rhode Island Secretary of State, who is a Democrat supporting photo ID, that state's legislature passed a photo ID law, and the sponsor was the only African-American state senator and the only African-American speaker that state has ever had in the state house. He said, if you can stop a problem before it metastasizes, if you can stop a problem before it gets bigger, and you can do it easily, you should do it. And that's what we did in Rhode Island.
Elizabeth, aren't the voters likely to vote anyway?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's in some ways asking the wrong question. Now certainly, as the Supreme Court noted in when it considered the Crawford case, you know, it's not really too much to ask a voter to, go even 100 miles away to a DMV to get an agency, the requisite ID. But when you're talking about the right to vote, which has been so hard won for so many people, and the burdens that are placed on that right, the federal court in the Texas case noted that, you know, even the most committed citizen would agree that a 200 to 250 mile round trip, especially for those people who don't have the driver's license in the first place, is why they need to go to the agency to get one, constitutes a substantial burden on the right to vote. And I think that's a problem from both a legal standpoint under the Voting Rights Act and those states that are covered, as well as from a political science perspective and, frankly, a values perspective. I don't want to say that, you know, we should make it so easy to cast your vote that we vastly increase the likelihood of voter fraud, but at the same time, I don't want to put substantial burdens on one of the most fundamental political liberties that our Constitution guarantees. So fundamental because it's really preservative of all the other rights that we hold dear in the Constitution. So, I think that there is a substantial burden. Is it substantial for everyone? No, absolutely not. And so the Supreme Court in Crawford rejected a facial challenge, which for non-lawyers is sort of, is this law unconstitutional in all its applications, but expressly left open the possibility that so-called as-applied challenges could be brought to voter ID laws, which would show, as the Texas court focused, that there is a substantial, legally relevant burden for some people.
Yeah, Elizabeth's point, I think, is one that's worth remarking on. I would be willing to bet that one day we'll have a Federalist Society launch on a fairly massive absentee ballot fraud. And, of course, absentee ballots have been pursued to make it easier and easier to vote. So your point is well taken on the easiness of voting. But now it's for you, the participants here in the lunch, to ask your questions. Please raise your hand and wait till the microphone comes, and I'll identify you by pointing at you rather rudely. But once you have the microphone, give us your name. If you want to, give us your affiliation, and then please pose your question to either of our speakers above. The lady in orange here.
My name is Rosemary Reed with DC Historical Society. There's two things I meant to ask. Nobody started out saying, what is the population of voters in America? I know we have a very low voting rate in America, but nobody actually said that. The second thing is that the whole point about voter ID is that the states that seem to be the most concerned also have a very bad history in terms of suppressing poor and Afro-American vote. In Texas that we kept hearing about, I don't see them going out with cars or vans to get more voters. I really can't imagine Mississippi and Alabama and all those other states, too. Unfortunately, I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm embarrassed. They were one of the states, but they're not states that are interested in increasing their voter registration.
Thank you. So the question I would believe is to, are these states making those kinds of efforts, or are we to draw other conclusions about their efforts, IDs?
You know, the states that are in the news are often in the news because they're covered by Section 8 of the Voting Rights Act. There are a lot of states that aren't covered by Section 8 of the Voting Rights Act that have enacted these laws. It was Democratic legislators in the state of New Hampshire that provided the crucial difference that allowed the state legislature to override the governor's veto of a voter ID law. It was Democrats who provided the margin of difference. 70% of Democratic legislators in the state of Kansas voted for that state's very strict photo ID law. As I mentioned previously, Rhode Island is 8-1 Democratic. They have a real voter fraud problem, both in person. In fact, the sponsor of the law, State Senator Harold Metz, the only African-American state senator, said, look, I did this because one of my relatives went to the polls and they discovered that someone had voted in their place already. He says, I know this happens. It happened to one of my relatives. So many states have done this. It's not just Texas. It's not just South Carolina. It's states all over the country, Indiana. And by the way, just one quick point. The most important part of this book are the stories of minority reformers who have their hopes crushed for good government. They labor in areas, whether it's rural or urban, where they're political machines. I don't care whether they're run by blacks or by whites. These political machines stay in power through voter fraud. Philadelphia, St. Louis, Detroit, the Black Belt of Alabama that Arthur Davis talks about. He said, you'd think voter fraud doesn't happen? There are FBI investigations all over my area and convictions and all over my district. Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick was a corrupt mayor of Detroit. He's now on federal court answering 15 charges of political corruption. He may have won his second term through voter fraud, massive absentee ballot fraud, massive misuse of ballots in Alzheimer's home patients. The city clerk of Detroit had to be physically removed from her office because she had either allowed this fraud to happen or abetted it. Kwame Kilpatrick won an election under a cloud. Detroit would have been much better off if Mayor Bing could have taken office, or the reformer that ran against Kwame Kilpatrick could have taken office earlier. The biggest victims of voter fraud in this country are minority voters in areas where there's a political machine that makes sure you can't fight City Hall because City Hall will steal your votes.
Look. Would you like to respond, Elizabeth, to the
question? Well, I think that's a really great question. And, you know, I think that what's important is not whether there are some Democrats who support these restrictive voting laws or not. Honestly, I don't care whether it's Democrats or Republicans who are passing these. What I care about is ensuring that the constitutional right to vote is not infringed upon, especially with unnecessary voter ID laws, which I don't think would really address the many compelling instances of corruption that Joe mentioned. And so I think that, you know, one thing that your question points out, that we have some of these restrictive laws in states like Texas and South Carolina, is the importance of the Voting Rights Act, which has the preclearance provision, which requires states like Texas and South Carolina to get permission to change their election procedures from the Department of Justice or a federal court. That's prevented these laws from going into effect. This Supreme Court term, I think it's important for everyone to pay attention to a case that seeks to strike down that preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act as unconstitutional. And I think without it, many of these states with a very dark history of discrimination could have their laws more easily go into effect.
Gentleman right here, wait a second. Right there.
Hello, my name is Sam Raymer, and my question is mainly for Elizabeth, but I'm sure John will want to chime in. Do you feel that it is a value issue to require identification and registration for handgun purchases in a similar way to voter ID laws, in that it affects the poor and minority members who can't get these IDs, can't travel to the place to get them? And if you don't feel that the two are the same, can you explain why?
You know, I think in some states it's easier to get a handgun than it is to cast your vote under restrictive voter ID laws. But
one state.
No, for example, you know, you can use your gun registration ID in some states, but you can't use, you know, an out-of-state driver's license, for example. I don't really know why that's...
It's out of state.
But not everyone drives in their state. You know, I think that, you know, we have
values. But they're supposed to vote in the state they live in. If you show an out-of-state license, that may show you actually are from out of state.
Or it means you don't drive in your state and you haven't gotten a new one.
But you're supposed to.
I think many of us in D.C. don't have cars. Do we all have driver's licenses? Not everyone has a passport. It's, you know, you don't always have the ID. But I want to be clear that I think the values that support making sure that the right to vote is not infringed is important, because it is preservative of the Second Amendment rights you talk about. It's preservative of First Amendment rights, because that's how you vote. That's how you get these rights protected by your local governments, is being able to cast your vote and saying, hey, we don't want restrictive handgun laws. And I will say, just because I'm sure you're skeptical, that I filed a brief in the Supreme Court supporting the incorporation of the Second Amendment to states and municipalities. So I do not disagree with you that an individual right to have a gun is a constitutional right and part of our values as well.
I support ID for holding firearms. I do.
Gentlemen here in front, we'll get to everyone, I think, today. Thank you. I'm Tom Sussman. And I have one quick question and one perhaps a little more detailed. The quick question is, I just don't know the answers. How difficult is it for people to get driver's licenses, for example, if they are from out of state or a non-citizen or a felon or live in two states, Florida and New York? I mean, it seems to me that we need the basis of comparison before we condemn felon voting as a basis for having voter ID. If felons need to drive to get to their, you know, parole officers' meetings, former felons. Why is that a remedy to these various problems? If someone lives in New York part of the time, in Florida part, they're going to have two driver's licenses. Well, how does voter ID help those? And the second one, no one's mentioned the cost of these programs. And I guess, John, you did mention that there are so many other infirmities in our election process at the states and local level. Is this distracting us? Are these various election boards saying, well, we've now solved it, we have a voter ID law, even though their machines don't work and they don't police absentee ballots and all these other problems? I wonder whether this is really focusing on the wrong issues.
Well, all of the states that have recently addressed this issue have done it comprehensively. I do not support some of the early states that just did voter ID. I think that's a rifle shot approach, and it's very limited, and it doesn't address the other issues that we need to address. But if you do three things in tandem, clean up the voter registration rolls, no one of any party should support the state they're in. Clean up absentee ballot fraud, and that can easily be done by asking people to submit the last five digits of their social security number and driver's license when they submit an absentee ballot. And even the critics of voter ID law will say there is absentee ballot fraud and it should be addressed. But whenever they're asked to support a specific absentee ballot fraud law that would clean up the system, they're nowhere to be found. In other words, they won't actually support it. They'll just say absentee ballot fraud is the real issue. And the third thing is voter ID. Voter ID will deter people. If you're presenting an out-of-state license, it's going to be examined more skeptically because, frankly, poll workers are taught, you know, people with out-of-state licenses might live out-of-state. That is a reasonable assumption in some cases. It will deter felons, the felons who were convicted. And by the way, how can they say there's no voter fraud in Minnesota? That all of this information on the felons came out after Al Franken was seated, and 198 people have already been convicted of a felony. How can you say there was no fraud in that election? They were convicted. And the rest, you know, well, they couldn't prove intent. So all of these things, including illegal aliens asked to produce an ID, they may not have one. That would deter them from voting. Voter ID law does not just address voter impersonation, not just the Eric Holder cases.
Elizabeth?
I think that's a really great question about cost, and it's also a question about priorities of where we spend our limited resources. I think that John's right, that everyone at this table agrees that absentee ballot fraud is really the worst problem out there. And the question is, why are we focusing all of this money and all of this sort of public discussion on voter ID laws? And, you know, I'm not one of these sort of vast conspiracy types, so, you know, I'm just going to go with what John said reportedly at a Heritage Foundation event, which is that Republicans like absentee ballots. So maybe that's why these Republican-supported voter ID laws are not focused more on absentee ballots than voter ID. But, you know, I think another question that I think conservatives should be particularly concerned about is, you know, what all this red tape that these voter ID laws are placing between a citizen and her right to vote. You know, I'm sure that if there, you know, were suggestions for increased red tape between a citizen and his right to get a handgun, you know, that would not be looked upon favorably. So, you know, we have this red tape, which also carries costs with it. In Pennsylvania, there have been studies that show that, you know, it would be impossible for the state of Pennsylvania to afford to produce a new card for everyone who needs one under its new law before the next election. So cost, I think, is a major issue, which I think would, frankly, make my conservative friends have some problems with some of these laws.
You know, I'm going to shock people, but, you know, I believe in limited government, but I believe in effective government. We don't spend enough time and energy and attention to our elections. The average poll worker is 70 years old. We need to encourage high school and college students to get credit for actually showing up at poll workers so they can learn something about our democracy. We should spend more money on voting machines. The reason why you often don't keep your ATM receipt is those machines are built to last and are quality. Our voting electronic machines often aren't nearly as expensive and sophisticated. I actually believe we should spend more on our elections, and just because I believe that doesn't mean I'm not a conservative. It just means that in the areas of the government that the Constitution actually says we should have, and running elections is one of them, I actually think we should spend enough money to make sure we have confidence in our elections.
Gentleman in the back.
Hello, I'm Eric Lobsinger. I'm a teaching fellow at Georgetown University Law Center, so thank you for your remarks. But I just wonder if there's a third way to all of this, if there's maybe some sort of middle ground, some sort of compromise, and putting cost issues aside. I mean, if theoretically we could actually have some sort of national photo ID, you know, say that's for free to every eligible American voter. Maybe, you know, something like a free passport, for example, to every American voter. Would that be an acceptable solution to both sides of this debate?
If the Cato Institute became a dead body.
Well, you know, your solution was supported by the National Commission on Election Reform, which was co-chaired by President Jimmy Carter. You know, people don't like to talk about this, but that commission, which was bipartisan, voted 18-3 in favor of photo ID. They just wanted a national one. And I think that the barriers to getting that anytime soon, in addition to being constitutional barriers and philosophical barriers and other barriers, are just insuperable. However, I will point out that the same people who say we were the only country in the world without a national health service, a national health system, are the same people who ignore that we're the only industrialized democracy that does not require people to show ID at the polls. You know, those viciously intolerant and fascist Canadians require ID at the polls. We all know how mean they are. Seriously, I think there is a compromise, and here's what I think it is. It's rooted in what Andrew Young, former mayor of Atlanta and former UN ambassador, told me. He said, let's have the biggest possible outreach to get people an ID. I think it's 0.5% that don't have it. That's what American University says. That's what the federal courts in Indiana and Georgia, which disagreed with the one in Texas. So I have two courts to your one, but we can play catch up later. And the Supreme Court. I believe it's 0.5%. The Brennan Center says it's 10%. Whatever it is, let's have a massive outreach effort. And for example, in Georgia, they had mobile vans going around trying to find people without an ID. You know what? They didn't find many. In South Carolina, they had a program. They offered a free ride and support for getting the documentation. You could get as many rides as you wanted in order to get the documentation, in order to get an ID. They offered free transportation. In 1 year, they had 23 requests. So regardless of how many it is, I say the solution is, let's get everyone an ID. Rather than fight it out in court, let's make sure everyone has one, because you can't be a fully functioning citizen in this country without one.
Every time there are roving vans in my neighborhood asking for my ID, I immediately run out the front
and
door.
And where do you live, my dear? Where do you live?
Washington, D.C.
Well, they don't have mobile vans.
But I think, to your question, I think that's a great idea. And I think that, people who support voter ID laws should, put their money where their mouth is. And if you want to send out free IDs to every eligible American voter, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not that showing ID is necessarily wrong. It's, are you overly restrictive in the kind of IDs that you require? And that's what separates some of these laws from others. And, if you had a truly free identification card where you're not charging people for underlying documents and you mail it to them, so they don't have these other barriers, then I think that'd be an entirely different question.
Lady in the back.
My name is Penny Eastman, and I'm with Morpho Trust USA, and my company makes 42 or 43 of the state driver's licenses around the country. We also make the passport card, which is this tiny little card that you can get as a passport that's only good for Canada, U.S., and Mexico, and the right. Caribbean, that's very easy to carry around. And this is not an ad for my company, but I just wanted to...
Some business after this.
Yeah, my card. But going back to what the gentleman from Georgetown University said, is I think really the key, one of the keys, is help people get IDs. Use the DMV system, use the Social Security system, use systems that are already established so that people aren't afraid of them. The national ID, I think, is never going to happen. Senator Schumer tried to do it, and he just got shot down as part of immigration reform. But I think that's really the way to go. Rather than argue about should people be able to vote, not vote, do they have an ID, do they not have an ID, let's get everyone an ID in this country. And it can be a variety of ways. I agree with both of you, and I certainly hope, Elizabeth, I don't think you are, that you're not promoting that people should go in and say, I'm Penny Eastman, I'm going to vote if they don't have an ID. I assume that you're not saying that.
You have to, at some point, under penalty of felony, I personally think that counts for something. We have many agreements in society, business, governmental, civic, where submitting an oath under a penalty of felony is sufficient. But there are ways that, for example, in a lot of states, you could use like a utility bill or something like that to prove who you are, or your voter registration card, or other forms of ID. The issue is not really ID or not. I agree with you. It's what kind of ID. And if it were so easy for everyone to access those agencies that you talk about, then we might have less of a problem. But there are, in some states, because of budget cuts, some of these agencies are only open, on the fifth Wednesday of every month. Well, there aren't that many months with five Wednesdays. Or only open 2 days a week. And so
can you give me an example of one of those places?
I can.
Okay.
Let me look through.
Well,
Where's the fifth
Wednesday example?
But before you, the other thing, John, is that's not true with DMVs. I mean, my company does driver's license. So the DMVs are open all the time. So I don't know about some of the other ones that Elizabeth's talking about. But
not all DMVs are open.
They're pretty much open a lot.
Okay, I'm waiting for the fifth
Wednesday
example.
We'll have to research that.
And most people have driver's licenses.
Well, let's go on and get some more questions. I want everyone to have a chance. The gentleman right here.
Mike Penders, Elizabeth. You cited a study with approval that failed to find sufficient evidence of a voter fraud. And that can be for a lot of reasons, including the rigor of the study.
The Carnegie Knight.
News 21 student group.
That can be for a lot of reasons, failure to find evidence of something as a form of prosecution. I can vouch for that. But then you challenge the investigation that was done in Minnesota as where they did investigate and actually prosecuted people for voter fraud as devoting too many resources. I'm just wondering if you can reconcile that.
Oh, I don't think I said they devoted too many resources. My point was that if you're going to throw, as Norm Coleman did, an army of lawyers at finding any way possible to strike votes so you can win, you're going to be pretty darn motivated to find instances of voter fraud, and they simply didn't in that 8 months that the court was going over this. And, you know, there have been prosecutions of felon voting from that election. I don't know where John gets his higher number.
Court records.
Well, I have also looked at the court records and got 164. But even if you look at 177, which is the other number I've heard, that's still, first of all, we don't know they all voted for Al Franken, and secondly, it's he won by 312 votes, and second place is still second place.
Well, we don't know how the felons voted, but we do know the following. A news organization went out and interviewed a bunch of those felons, and 9 out of 10 said they voted for Al Franken. That's anecdotal in a poll, but it's better than the Brennan Center's poll. Academic studies have shown that, felons come in all shapes and sizes. I suspect a majority of white-collar felons vote Republican. I suspect a majority of other felons vote another way. Academic studies have shown that Bill Clinton won 93% of the felon vote in 1996. Those are by liberal academics. I don't know how people voted. I do know that 1,100 illegal felon votes in this election won by 312 votes is troubling. And as for the incompetence of Norm Coleman's lawyers, you betcha they were incompetent. And I specify that, and I will grant that. I think the crux of this is we are spending an awful lot of time and effort on something that wasn't controversial until just a few years ago. The National Election Commission, chaired by Jimmy Carter, had no problem with photo ID. It voted 18-3, bipartisan for it. The Help America Vote Act, which was co-sponsored by an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, included a photo ID provision. If you register by postcard and apply for an absentee ballot, the first time you actually have to show up in person with an ID to prove you're actually a living human being. That's a federal voter ID requirement. It goes back to 2002. And it was passed bipartisan, Democrats controlling the Senate, Republicans controlling the House. This didn't used to be controversial. I say let's return to the days when it wasn't controversial. And I support far bigger efforts than are currently going on to outreach to those people who don't have an ID and get them one. And I know Pennsylvania allocated $10 million, it should be more. I know Texas has allocated some, it should be more. But wouldn't that be a better way to solve this problem than giving all the money to the lawyers and the publicists and having endless lawsuits about this? I think that'd be a much better way to go.
One more question. Lady down front.
Hi, my name is Shelby. I'm black. I'm from an inner city. I'm from Detroit. And I wanted to make two quick comments. The first one is I'm getting so very sick of the victimization that I'm hearing from people about blacks and our inability to get an ID. I wanted to make a statistic. In the city of Detroit, the number one business in my city is a liquor store. If voter ID was a problem, I promise you the liquor lobbies would be going off the handle screaming how minorities can't get access to the liquor stores in downtown Detroit or Baltimore or D.C. So I think that what too many people on the left do is you guys play this race game of victimization to make it so if anyone's against it, we're racist. And I think that what you all need to be very careful of is this narrative and this characterization that because I'm black, I'm a victim and incapable. I am fully capable of saving my money to get an ID. If that means I choose not to buy a pair of shoes because I believe in the right to vote, I will do that. When I turned 18, I had the choice to go to homecoming or get my voter registration. I went and I got my voter ID because it was important to me. So I think you guys would do a lot better if you would stop looking at me as if I need your help and start expecting me to be an American, an adult, and take personal responsibility for my life. Stop pandering to us. Stop expecting us to not be capable. I have a brain. I can long-term plan for things. And there's no barrier of someone saying that I can't vote. The number one issue is majority of minorities don't vote and we don't care. That's the real issue. Black people in general just don't vote in large numbers because we don't see the change. And my last comment with John, I wanted to thank you for bringing up the suppression of those of us in inner cities that have been trying to change things. I'm a registered Republican in my city. My vote was not counted, and I know that for a fact. And there were a lot of people, black African Americans that are Republicans, that try to change things in our cities and were suppressed. So maybe if you guys are really concerned about voter suppression, why don't you really care about black voters then and not just, it seems to be, the black political democratic machine?
The first part was to Elizabeth, so let's start with Elizabeth.
Yeah, you know, I certainly hear you, and I apologize if there was anything I said that you took offense to. You know, I'm not supporting victimizing anyone. You know, what I am supporting is making sure that the guarantees in our Constitution of the right to vote for all Americans, and specifically under the 15th Amendment for people of any race or ethnicity, are guaranteed to all Americans. And so I don't think that's playing a race card. You know, I'm sorry if you felt that way. But, you know, I think that's just trying to follow through on what we fought so hard and what previous generations of Americans fought so hard to do, which was to ensure the franchise to all equally and to make sure that we all, especially those of us who weren't included in the founding's generation of citizens, are able to be full and equal citizens. And I think that, you know, when you look at some of the states like Texas, for example, and other states, you can look at the vast record put together by Congress when they reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006. Unfortunately, there are places where there still remains outright voter discrimination based on race, ethnicity, gender. And so, you know, I wish that we were in a place where it was just simply a matter of personal responsibility and, you know, as you talk about, but in many places, I don't think that that's the case, or at least the record before Congress that was put together by experts say that isn't the case. But I take your point, and, you know, certainly there is some level of individual responsibility, and I think that's sort of some of the difference between what the court in Texas talks about, people who live in cities who might have greater access to the agency that gives its identification, and people who might live 250 miles or more from the agency where they can get theirs. And, you know, it's there are real burdens that have been categorized by the courts and Congress, et cetera.
Well, first of all, if somebody really lives 250 miles away, I suggest they vote absentee. And everyone has a Social Security number. That's no barrier to voting. Let me try to lower the temperature here. I think everything that Shelby said was very stirring and very persuasive, but she did use the word, the R word, racist. You know, I want to make an appeal to people on all sides of an issue. You know, we used to have a time in the 50s and 60s where we yelled communist under every bed. It eventually lost all meaning. It was a substitute for thought and an automatic detour away from rational discussion. I'll make a personal plea here. We need to realize what racism is. It's a belief in the superiority of one race over another. It doesn't involve every slight, every insult, or anything else that happens. Let's actually call racist what it really is and not use the term for other things because it devalues and I think lowers the impact of the word, and it helps us not really find real racism when we find it. I have been called a racist on this issue so many times I have a rhinoceros hide. The Nation magazine just yesterday said there's a special place in hell for me for my role in voter suppression. Well, look, you know, I can be a big boy, I can take it. But seriously, this has become You know, when you call someone a communist and they're not a communist, when you call someone a racist and they're not a racist, it just is a substitute for thought and the kind of informed discourse that we should have. You know, let's presume that people on both sides of this issue have sincere motives and evidence on their side that they sincerely believe, and that they actually are not operating primarily from racial motives. One way or another, either it's from patronization, as Shelby mentioned, or from the desire to suppress voters. Let's give people the benefit of the doubt on good intentions, and let's not retreat to the R word at the first instance.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both of our panelists today. And remember, we've had a very excellent panel, I think, on voting fraud. If it's piqued your interest, remember the book is Who's Counting? Our co-author is John Fund, that's F-U-N-D, if you want to go to your local bookstore and have some good reading before November 6th. In general, I'd like to thank everyone for coming today and the Federalist Society for holding this event. Thank you.